You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nina Mayfair.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden to discuss his recent story. It's called City Hires Independent Law Firm for Zenith Investigation. The city's internal investigation of its contract with the fossil fuel company faced bias claims and missed multiple deadlines. City councilors pressured the mayor to hire outside help. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. You've got a Zenith investigation update for us today, now that Portland Mayor Keith Wilson has hired an outside law firm for the investigation. What will this law firm be doing?
Yeah, as you may recall, the City Council passed in March a resolution calling on investigation into Zenith Energy, not only whether or not Zenith broke its franchise agreement with the city, but also into some of the steps around how the city operated with Zenith and what that process looked like. Environmental advocates for a long time have called this more of like a backroom deal in the way that the city has interacted with this Houston-based fossil fuel company. And this investigation is meant to kind of, you know, elucidate like what happened here in this process. The news of this independent law firm called Cable Huston, a local law firm, came just last week. Michael Jordan updated city councilors saying that they had hired this law firm. And they are, you know, essentially going to look through, they were hired to provide sort of an extra eye on what the city has already found. So it doesn't really appear that they are fully independent so much as providing an outside perspective on an internal investigation that the city is already doing.
Right, because initially City Council voted to have city staff handle the internal investigation of how the city administration had dealt with Zenith in the past. What changed? Why bring in this outside firm?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing because Councillor Dunphy, you know, I spoke to him the other day about this because he had brought in the city council resolution initially said that they wanted an outside investigator, not city staff, in part because the city staff who has been approving these permits for Zenith for a long time had been very involved in that process, even drafting, you know, these agreements sort of together. And it just seemed like a little bit of a conflict of interest to have those same city staff doing that investigation. Councillor Dunphy, you know, sort of said he may have been wrong about that when he proposed an amendment in March to the resolution to pull out the independent investigation and allow city staff to do it initially to see if Zenith had broken this franchise agreement. You know, From his perspective, he said, you know, he would always prefer to have, he believes in city staff, and he would prefer always to have city staff doing the work of the city rather than hire an outside contractor. But he said in this case, he actually support, he feels that he was wrong in that case, and he supports this. Now, this first came up because city councilors Mitch Green and Anolita Morillo brought up to the mayor that it seemed a little bit bizarre to have the same city staff who had been approving these permits all along doing the internal investigation. And they sent an email pressuring the mayor to hire an outside firm instead, calling it, you know, saying that it could be a clear conflict of interest. The outline that the mayor's chief of staff had sent to the city councilors was going to require a 90-day report, 120-day report, but the list of names of people that were doing this investigation were all the exact same people that you've seen over the last, you know, 3 to 4 years interacting with Zenith and approving their permits in the first place. It would just be strange to expect them to say, no, we actually think that we approved those incorrectly. And so that's why these city councilors called for an outside firm to do this investigation.
So with the outside law firm hired on to sort of oversee or investigate the investigation, what sort of hand do those folks that you mentioned who've been involved for a long time, what hand do they have in the process now?
Well, there's still some open questions about this as far as what documents the law firm will be getting. So if the city is responsible for handing over documents, they have published, you know, 4,000 pages or so of some public records around Zenith's permitting processes over the last few years. But will they be giving the law firm, you know, say internal communications between city staffers? Street Roots reported on this and published, I believe, like 9 stories or so in the month of December and January about some of these communications that did give a little bit of fuel to the advocates' concerns that it was a more of a backroom deal. Will the city turn those over to Cable Huston, you know, is a bit of an open question. I will add, I think this is a good place to add that Street Roots has published all of the public records that we obtained through our public records request since last December at streetroots.org. Those are available to anyone who wants to peruse those documents and see what they can see. A lot of really confusing information in there, but, you know, these are public officials and those are public communications.
Well, like you said, you talked to Councillor Jamie Dunphy as well, and he said that a report like this may come back, quote, mealy-mouthed. Can you break that down? What did he mean by that, and what would he have city council do if that's the case?
Right. Dunphy has been, you know, a city councilor, you know, for 9 months, but he also has worked in government over the years, previously in Nick Fish's office, and, you know, he's been around a lot of these reports over the years. So he was telling me, you know, a lot of times when the city hires a contractor, the contractor will go, they'll look at some of the information, and then they come back with a report that kind of, you know, toes the line. It doesn't necessarily say one thing or another. It just kind of presents some things. And historically, you know, particularly under the commission form of government that we had for the last 100+ years, you know, the bureau, you know, commissioners just kind of accept the report, go, okay, cool, and then nothing changes. The new form of government is much more responsive to people, and Councillor Dunphy said that he recognized that this is a really important issue for a lot of people. And he said, you know, if they don't compel documents from the city that are showing how city staff, you know, operated with this fossil fuel company, you know, then he'll send them back to do one that really is, you know, a truly independent investigation that covers all of the facts and hold them accountable for that. Again, you know, he said he's not sure there is a smoking gun here, and, you know, it's important for people to be kind of open to that, but that is what transparency offers, you know, for the public, is that they can sort of accept results when they believe that the process has been sufficiently transparent.
What sort of new options might be available to the city if the investigation comes back to show that Zenith did break city law in their pipeline building and in their operations?
Well, you know, the biggest sort of response would be that the mayor can revoke Zenith's permit the franchise agreement, and that franchise agreement is the thing that keeps Zenith operating in the city. There are all kinds of permits, land use statements. Particularly when you read these stories, you know, you come across all kinds of conditional use things and all kinds of city permitting processes. But this franchise agreement is a big one. It's allows them to operate within the city's rights of way, meaning they have pipes under Front Avenue in Northwest Portland. It has to do with how they can construct those and legally continue to operate them. And if that agreement was violated and the mayor decided to revoke it, you know, they would have a lot of trouble continuing to do business in the city. However, fossil fuel companies for a long time have argued that their infrastructure is necessary, and they'll argue that in court until, you know, whoever is suing them is bankrupted. And so there are a lot of sort of fights ahead, but the city could fine them, you know, in a significant way that makes it so that they actually alter some of their practices. They violated things over and over again, and it appears with Zenith, as with every fossil fuel company who's ever existed, you know, doing these like sort of settlements and paying fees is just sort of a, you know, you have to spend money to make money, right? And it's just kind of baked into the cake. That's how fossil fuels operate worldwide. And so, you know, we'll see what the city is able to do to actually hold them accountable.
There were also some missed deadlines for when some of this reporting would be coming in. You mentioned it a little bit, but what happened there?
Yeah, I think a few things have kind of changed. But, you know, the city council resolution was really clear that the city administrator must deliver a 120-day report that would put, you know, from March to July. It was sort of mid-July, and that report never came. There was sort of an outline of what this investigation was to look like. Certainly, you know, having some complaints from city councilors and then sort of pivoting and hiring a new law firm would kick that back. But there's really no clarity on what will happen when that report is late. I brought this up to Councillor Dunphy, you know, sort of with some other hypotheticals. If this was any other issue and the city council had required any other bureau or any other city administrator to come back with a report, would they kind of let it slide? And to me, this Zenith thing, it represents very much the specifics of the Zenith case, but it also represents, in a new form of government, we're 9 months in, how does the executive branch and, you know, the sort of legislative branch of the city council operate? And there are a lot of gaps in the way that this charter was set up. And if the executive branch is allowed to sort of miss deadlines here and there, what does that mean for the power of the city council, and how can they enforce that on the executive branch?
When is the report expected now?
City Administrator Michael Jordan said in a recent city council meeting that he expected it to take months, and hopefully it would be there by the end of the year.
What do you hope listeners take away from this story?
I guess part of the, you know, what I said before is a really important aspect of this, which is just what does, when the city council passes, you know, a legislative, you know, piece of legislation and demanding that, you know, the executive branch does something, what does it mean? How do they hold them accountable, and how do they do that in public? The public has, for a long time, as Councillor Canal said in the meeting about the Zenith resolution, he said, you know, the public has been telling the city council for a very long time what it wants, and then it is being given some, you know, bureaucratic reason that thing can't happen. And there's a big opportunity here with a 12-member city council, with a somewhat weak mayor system of government, to be able to be responsive to the people. And I think that, you know, Portlanders are smart. When things are out in the public, Portlanders respond to that. They know how to get things moving in a direction that's better for the city. And that is something that the city council has the opportunity to sort of inculcate in our ways of being here.
Good use of the word inculcate. If our listeners are interested, where can they find out more?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. We have a very beautiful cover, as ever, designed by Etta O'Donnell King, Street Roots illustrator. And you can also you can buy a copy from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org. And those public records are also available at streetroots.org.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Jeremiah. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me and welcome back.
That was Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden speaking with me about his recent story. It's called City Hires Independent Law Firm for Zenith Investigation. The city's internal investigation of its contract with the fossil fuel company faced bias claims and missed multiple deadlines. City councilors pressured the mayor to hire outside help. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today I'm joined by Oregon Arts Watch Executive Director Laura Grimes. Thanks for being here with me today, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Hannah.
Absolutely. So the first article that I want to talk about today is Tryon Creek's New Education Pavilion, a home for Indigenous art and culture. The $2.6 million pavilion is set to open September 20th. It is designed after Chinook plank houses and will offer two large classrooms for environmental and cultural programs. Will you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, Tryon Creek is this beautiful state park. It's a preserved natural area located right in Portland, which is unusual to have it right in a metropolitan area. It has 665 acres and lots of hiking, biking, and horse trails. It's in southwest Portland, just off of Terwilliger Boulevard near Lewis and Clark College between Portland and Lake Oswego. And so it's supported by this nonprofit group called Friends of Tryon Creek that raised, at least $2.6 million to build this pavilion, like you mentioned, that is set to open September 20th. And it's remarkable that it has this organization to support it. The park was created in the 1960s as part of a grassroots effort to save the land from development. And so it has the wonderful support of this nonprofit group, which is unusual in its own right that a state park would have such a valuable resource. That a nonprofit group like this can pull off a capital campaign and build a new pavilion. So hats off to them. It's quite a feat. So this new pavilion will include these two large classrooms that will be for educational programs, to study environmental and cultural lessons, and it will include original carved wooden pieces and metal fish sculptures, all commissioned from notable Northwest Indigenous artists. So this new classroom space will celebrate Indigenous culture and really honor the history of the land.
Amazing. Thanks. The other article I wanted to chat with you about is Enebriani, a telenovela of a folk opera. Composer San Cha's opera premieres at Portland's TBA Festival and finds inspiration from over-the-top Mexican soap operas. Will you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, it's a folk opera that's opening. And like you mentioned, it has its inspiration from these dramatic, over-the-top telenovelas, which are Mexican soap operas. The show is composed by Sancha, like you mentioned, and it tells a story of Dolores, a working-class farm laborer who's also at a turning point. Remain in a loveless marriage to a wealthy, abusive spouse, or risk poverty and social scorn to seek authentic fulfillment elsewhere. Apparently, in the folk opera, the answer erupts in an ecstatic encounter with an embodied spirit. So I'm very curious about that. So the Arts Watch story talks about how Sancha has a lot of aspects to her identity, to her personality, which all influence her creative expression. She crosses a lot of musical genres, incorporating different styles of Mexican music and pop music. So this overly dramatic telenovela style to do this folk opera gave her the freedom to explore lots of different ideas. This production is co-presented by Boom Arts and PICA's TBA Festival. It's playing September 5th and 6th in Portland 5's Dolores Winningstad Theater. So you can see the show about Dolores at the Dolores Winningstad Theater. I just kind of thought that'd be fun to say. This show is part of TBA 25, which is also called Time-Based Art Festival. It's a whirlwind of lots of shows, contemporary dance, poetry, performance art. It runs September 4th through 14th in four venues around Portland.
Wow, that's really cool. I've actually never heard about the Time-Based Art Festival.
Oh, yeah, it's been for quite a while. More than, gosh, I want to say 25 years at least.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, just a collection of all types of, we'll say, performance art. Kind of, it incorporates a variety of artists from both locally, nationally, internationally. It's really an opportunity to experience a variety of art forms that, that don't really, they don't always fit a particular style of art. It's not just visual art. It's not just like a typical type of performance, like a dance or a theater. It's usually performance art of some type. So it's usually really cutting edge, and sometimes you really don't know what you're going to get. You get really sort of unusual styles of art. Some of it can be very interesting, and some of it, might not be to your liking. So it can really be a variety, but it's a great way to be exposed to a lot of different artworks and to, experience them with other people. Like it's an opportunity, and a lot of this is really sort of cutting edge art. So it's interesting to see what ideas are out there. So I find that intriguing that this folk opera is going to be performed. It seems like the kind of unusual sort of piece that doesn't quite fit any particular genre to be featured at TBA. It seems like it would fit right in there.
Wow, thanks. Yeah. You got any upcoming stories that people should keep their eyes out for?
Let me think. I can't think of any right now. It's the first of the month, and so we usually post a lot of weekly columns, so you can find out what's happening for the whole month in visual arts. Like we have Visual Arts Monthly, we have Dance Watch Monthly. So there's usually a music column, choral. So there's always columns to tell you all the different types of activities that you can enjoy throughout the whole month. It's kind of a great way to plan your calendar.
Amazing. And where can folks read these articles?
You can find stories about the stories that I just talked about and a lot more, and all of the monthly calendars. You can find it all at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Hannah.
Here's some recent positive stories from H2O Radio you might have missed.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
And I'm Franny Halperin. What do you get when you mix seawater with recycled soda cans and coffee? According to researchers at MIT, you get green hydrogen, a clean source of energy that many hope can replace fossil fuels.
Current methods to create green hydrogen are expensive and use electricity from renewable energy sources like solar or wind to split the hydrogen from the oxygen and water. It differs from the cheaper blue hydrogen that uses fossil fuels to extract the element.
Last year, the MIT team looked for less costly ways to break water that didn't contribute to climate change. They knew that aluminum generates hydrogen when it comes in contact with water, but don't think you can just drop a soda can in a bucket and expect a chemical reaction, because once aluminum has been exposed to the air, it forms a protective oxide layer, and the process stops before it can get started.
So as lead researcher Ali Kumbari explained to H2O Radio, they experimented with ways to penetrate that oxide layer to harvest the aluminum and found that an alloy called gallium indium did the trick.
Unfortunately, that alloy is rare and expensive, so although a great way to get pure aluminum into water and create hydrogen, it wasn't sustainable.
So they went to the beach. Instead of fresh water, Kumbari says he scooped up some seawater near Boston, which it turns out can capture the alloy so it can be used over and over.
Great, right? Not yet. The seawater converted the aluminum to hydrogen really slowly, so Kumbari had to be resourceful again. He and his team tinkered in the kitchen, looking for ways to speed things up. And we all know there's a substance in our houses that amps us up, and it worked here too. Caffeine.
When they added coffee grounds to seawater and the aluminum, the reaction was fast, producing hydrogen in 5 minutes compared to 2 hours without caffeine.
Next, the team tested their aluminum-based hydrogen to power an electric vehicle and an EV bicycle. Kumbari says the bike ran for 2 hours before needing another feeding of hydrogen, and says the solution has potential for ocean-going vessels because you wouldn't have to carry around seawater. It's right there.
The research has been met with much enthusiasm because ocean water is abundant, and aluminum is Earth's third most common element. Furthermore, the solution doesn't use fresh water, which is constrained around the globe.
More good news is that the method creates byproducts called baymite and pyrite, which are in high demand to fabricate semiconductors, electronic elements, and many industrial products, meaning their hydrogen solution would be both sustainably green and economically in the black. Many people have doorbell cameras to see who's there or whether a package has been delivered. But now, those devices could tell you if your sprinklers need to run.
Home irrigation systems are often programmed to automatically go on and off at set times and days. But when it rains, it's not uncommon for sprinklers to run even when not needed.
An innovation called ERIC, developed at Texas A&M University, claims to cut down on excess watering by turning doorbell cameras into rainfall monitors.
It works by analyzing the camera footage using machine learning models to determine how much rain has fallen and automatically adjusts both the duration and day that the irrigation controller waters a lawn.
The team says their new AI-enhanced tool can save homeowners up to 9,000 gallons of water a month. And finally, Magellanic penguins are named after the Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan, who saw the birds in the early 1500s during his first voyage around the tip of South America.
While his crew used a quadrant and a compass to find their way, they could have learned a thing or two about navigation from the penguins, so says a new study.
Researchers from Swansea University and the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior say the flightless birds have a secret strategy for finding their way home after swimming far from land. land, which they do to find food for their chicks.
The birds, which are just over 2 feet tall, can't really get their bearings in rough seas by sticking their heads above the water to look for landmarks. So how did they know which way to go?
To find out, the team put GPS devices on penguins from a colony living off Argentina's coast and discovered that instead of swimming in a straight line back to shore, the penguins often followed curved S-shaped paths driven by the currents.
They say the birds seem to sense both the presence and strength of these currents and to understand tidal cycles in which water moves first in one direction and then reverses. If the penguins were carried too far out by a tide, they seem to know they'll be brought back in later.
The study found that the birds could stick the landing and arrive within 300 meters of their departure point, some even at night.
This remarkable navigation strategy helped the penguins not only to conserve energy, but also increase the amount of food they gathered simply by taking the long way home.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOOs, loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOOs Out Loud fall membership drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made, community